This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, June 28th, 2002. I'm Nell Abram, in for Deepa Fernandez. The G8 wraps up a two-day summit by endorsing the New Partnership for Africa's Development, or NEPAD. China rejects a UN report predicting an explosive HIV and AIDS epidemic there. We'll conclude our two-part look at the rights of gay men and lesbians in China. And the Navy conducts live bombing exercises in New Brunswick, Maine. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Rob Manning with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Democratic members of the U.S. House are angry with the Republican-sponsored prescription drug plan that narrowly passed this morning. Jenny Bruhlheide reports from Washington, D.C.
House Republicans and the White House praised the new plan today, but California Democrat Pete Stark says the plan grossly underfunds prescription drugs for seniors.
It's interesting that we've got a benefit that's 50% more generous as members of Congress than the bill the Republicans were willing to pass for seniors. And I'm a bit embarrassed. I hope they are.
Claiming procedural rules, the Republican House leadership refused to bring the Democratic prescription drug plan to a vote on the House floor. In addition to other differences, the deductible under the Republican prescription drug plan is $250 compared to $100 in the Democratic version. The patient copay also rises much more rapidly after the first $1,000 under the Republican plan than under its Democratic counterpart. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, this is Jenny Bruhlheide.
G8 leaders meeting in Canada have pledged $20 billion over the next 10 years to dispose of Russian chemical and nuclear weapons. But as Lira Bardis reports, they did nothing about the global small arms trade.
In an effort to thwart terrorists, the United States will provide $10 billion for the project, matched by the six other G8 nations, excluding Russia. The leaders' last-minute joint statement Thursday night says nuclear submarines, nuclear materials, and employment for former weapons scientists are priorities. What was not a priority in Kananaskis was the continuing global trade in small arms to despotic regimes. Alex Mead with Amnesty International.
This harrowing humanitarian tragedy will only be curtailed by tough new G8 laws, not guidelines. Once again, they have dropped the ball.
Lee Robartis, Free Speech Radio News, Calgary.
Both the Senate and House have approved defense spending bills, which now must be reconciled between the two chambers. Gareth Schweitzer has more from D.C.
With little opposition, the Senate approved a $393 billion defense spending bill, which now must be reconciled with a House bill passed earlier this month. The Senate bill contains a contentious amendment which lifts a six-year-old ban on privately funded abortions for overseas military personnel and a provision giving full retirement pay to veterans already receiving disability. Most Republicans oppose both measures. Sarah Flounders of International Action, an anti-militarism activist group, says the massive defense bills come at the expense of other domestic priorities.
This is money that enriches a handful of stockholders, and it is money stolen from education, from health care, from everything that we need here.
The defense bills increase spending on fighter planes and warships, as well as a missile defense system many Democrats are skeptical will ever function properly, and takes dollars away from immediate anti-terrorism spending. In Washington, D.C., for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gareth Schweitzer.
Hundreds of supporters turned out as the president of Puerto Rico's pro-statehood party appeared in San Juan's Commonwealth Court today to answer for his insistence on bringing the U.S. flag into Puerto Rican courtrooms. Shannon Novak reports.
Last week, the president of Puerto Rico's pro-statehood New Progressive Party, Carlos Pesquera, and party members forced themselves and a United States flag in the locked doors of a government office that was not displaying the U.S. flag. The pro-statehooders broke glass to enter and then pushed and knocked down employees and journalists to place the U.S. flag. Several people were injured, including a police officer. Mr. Pesquera, the party's current gubernatorial candidate, and four other party members have been charged with aggression, disturbance of the peace, and restriction of liberty. 400 police officers have been dispatched to a pro-statehood rally at the San Juan Courthouse. The battle of the flags began 1 year ago today when a riot broke out in San Juan at a replica of the Vieques Chapel. Pro-statehooders had clashed with members of the resistance who want the U.S. Navy to end bombing practice on Vieques Island. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Shannon Novak.
Last, among the handful of decisions the U.S. Supreme Court delivered yesterday was a little-noticed ruling opening the door for civil penalties in the cruel and unusual practice of tying prisoners to so-called hitching posts. Alabama had chained prisoners to posts intermittently for years, though not since 1998. Richard Cohen of the Southern Poverty Law Center says the question went beyond stopping the practice to include civil damage liability for guards.
The reason they stopped doing it was because we sued them, and the question in the Supreme Court was whether people could sue for damages for the being put on the hitching post.
The High Court ruled that guards can face civil penalties even if they were following orders. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Rob Manning.
The Group of Eight concluded its two-day summit by endorsing the New Partnership for Africa's Development, or NEPAD, offering billions of dollars in aid to nations that embrace capitalism. Activists called the G8 agreement a revised version of the old model of foreigners dictating what others must do, backed by vague promises of aid that never materializes. Critics also say the G8 plan fails to emphasize the AIDS pandemic in Africa and that the only initiative regarding water involved privatization. President Bush, who last month signed a law increasing subsidies for U.S. farmers, refused to drop restrictions on bringing African goods into the United States. Canada unilaterally pledged to lift tariffs on goods from 48 poor countries, 34 of them in Africa, by January 1, 2003. Thatcher Collins has more from Calgary.
African leaders came to Calgary seeking more than $60 billion in aid, but the commitment they got from G8 leaders was for $6 billion, and that had strings attached. Canadian Prime Minister Jean Chrétien.
NEPAD is a set of criteria that they have chosen themselves. And we say, if you implement these conditions, this money will be there. If they were not, that's why we had to put the word could there.
South African President Thabo Mbeki helped draw up the NEPAD agreement. He says it's unclear whether they will get any of the proposed aid.
Well, maybe you should pose that question to the G8. We might answer it wrongly.
In order to get the aid offered under NEPAD, African nations will need to meet vaguely stated criteria, trade liberalization, and what G8 calls good governance. It's likely the G8 will enforce these conditions through the international organizations that they control, the World Trade Organization, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank. Indeed, NEPAD sees private corporate investment, rather than aid, as the key to development on the African continent. Pam Foster of the nonprofit Halifax Institute says that most of the foreign direct investment that comes to poor countries is in the form of speculative currency trading, traded on a volume around 68 times that of the trade of real goods and services.
Because it failed to contain the financial crisis that came out in 1993-94 with Mexico. So in 1995, the bank and the fund were put on the G8 agenda. We've seen since then many more financial crises occurring. The reasons for this: increased financial liberalization. They're continuing to push increased financial liberalization. They're continuing to ignore a concrete solution, which would be the implementation of a tax on currency speculation.
South Africa is the least stable region and most likely to suffer a similar economic crisis. MP Giyose of Jubilee South Africa.
Why is President Mbeki apparently the main man who is running around with this ball? The South African government already has a GEAR program, which is a South African counterpart of NEPAD. That GEAR program is being driven by South African corporations. If you look at that, you then can understand the fact that those same companies have not only taken over the direction of policy in South Africa, these same companies are scattered all over Africa.
Corporate control and privatization is increasing the poverty in South Africa, according to Virginia Setshedi of the Soweto Electricity Crisis Committee.
In the townships, we are paying something like 32 cents per kilowatt. In the suburbs, they are paying only 17 cents per kilowatt. And it goes further. We found out that the big companies, the BMWs, the Volkswagens, who are using electricity all the time, they are paying 7 cents per kilowatt.
Dr. Weissman Nakulu, economic advisor to President Mbeki and chairperson of NEPAD.
Because what happened after 1973, as a result of the oil crisis, the majority of the African economies became weak, and they became dependent on donors World Bank, IMF, and they lost control of their policies. They tried a number of times to come up with their own visions for the development of the continent. But the Lagos plan could not be funded, so it could not take off. Why? It was an African vision. It could just not get acceptance by the funders.
When the Organization of African Unity meets in 2 weeks, it will disband and reform as the African Union, adopting NAPAD as part of its charter and legislating NAPAD's policies in each member country. Following the WTO's Doha Declaration, dubbed the Development Round, the G8 nations will finance and train the public officials that deal with economic policy in African countries. During the same round, the WTO member states were obliged to allow the production of generic AIDS drugs. But Dr. James Orbinski of Doctors Without Borders says that this is being undermined by the G8 nations.
As we speak in Geneva at the WTO TRIPS Council, the United States and the European Union are very much siding with the pharmaceutical industry in terms of these safety, these flexibility measures within the TRIPS agreement. And they're supporting what I would describe as a highly restrictive, patent-positive perspective to the issue of access to essential medicines in the developing world.
The next G8 summit will be in July, starting in St. Petersburg and finishing in France. Thatcher Collins for Free Speech Radio News in Calgary.
A federal judge is expected to rule today in a dispute between the Yankton Sioux Nation, the U.S. Army, and the state of South Dakota. The fight is over a Yankton burial ground called the North Point Gravesite. The North Point land is part of the traditional homeland of the Yankton Sioux along the Missouri River and holds the bones of their ancestors. U.S. Army bulldozers and cranes are standing by, ready to dig up the site for a festival ground if the judge lifts his restraining order. Amanda Holmes has the story.
On May 14th, the state began digging at North Point for fill dirt, unearthing human remains and native ceremonial items. Without notifying the tribe of the discovery, the bones and objects were removed to a state anthropologist office in Rapid City. For 15 days, the tribe was not notified about what had been found, as required by the federal law known as NAGPRA, or the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. When tribal members heard their ancestors' graves were being desecrated, they went to the site.
A group of four of us went out there.
Faith Spotted Eagle of the Braveheart Society.
And viewed the site and noticed that construction was still being done in this huge landfill area, or this barrow, and there were trucks that were hauling dirt out of that area. And so at that point, I went there, I saw one of the construction workers, a very young man, and I told him, I said, you know, this is illegal because you have not consulted with us according to some of the federal laws. You haven't even talked to us.
They returned later to find that more dirt had been removed. Again, Faith Spotted Eagle.
As we drove up to the ridge, which is on a beautiful, beautiful ridge overlooking the Missouri River, on the north side of the river, we came into this clearing where a road had been scraped off into this huge barrow pit. I would say it's about 3 acres in size. And I turned around and you could see a couple of the tops of the skulls sticking out. And they said that they had walked through the area and they identified other bone scatter. On the north side of the fill, there was a leg bone sticking up out of the ground, embedded, and then there was also a vertebrate laying right on top of it. So there was bone scattered probably from their primary spots as the earth movers scraped the area. I'm sure they scattered them all over.
U.S. District Court Judge Lawrence Pearsall granted a 10-day restraining order against the state. Mary Wynn is the Yankton tribal attorney.
Essentially, the judge has indicated that he doesn't see a problem with what the Corps of Engineers has done. He's indicated that at this juncture, he will not order the Corps of Engineers to return those remains removed from their permanent resting place and their sacred site of resting place. He will not order the Corps of Engineers to stop work all over the North Point area. He did order the Corps of Engineers to stop work at the three sites where we could actually prove that non-Indians have seen and recognized human remains.
If the temporary restraining order is lifted this Friday, June 28th, trucks poised at the site will continue to remove the bones of Yankton ancestors, crush them, and use them for fill dirt at a sewage treatment facility and a campsite commemorating the state's 100th anniversary celebration of the coming of Lewis and Clark next year. Again, Faith Spotted Eagle.
So essentially, these campers will be sleeping on remains.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Amanda Holmes.
The House of Representatives and the Senate passed separate bills that would give the Defense Department its biggest spending increase in decades. The
The moves came after the Senate agreed on spending for missile defense, and both chambers voted to allow the Bush administration to kill the Army's Crusader artillery system. The Senate bill, which totals $393 billion, doesn't appropriate any money, but does spell out how it should be spent. The $354.7 billion House version is the first of 13 appropriations bills needed to fund the federal government in the upcoming fiscal year. The House version also grants the Defense Department complete immunity from the Migratory Bird Treaty Act and provides broad leeway for the Defense Department to ignore the Endangered Species Act that, among other things, requires protective measures for endangered marine mammals. In New Brunswick, Maine, the Navy has been conducting live bombing exercises that put endangered humpback whales, fin whales, and right whales at serious risk. Emily Bernhard has this report.
Reached today at the Brunswick Naval Air Station, a U.S. Navy spokesperson refused to confirm live firebombing exercises in the Gulf of Maine. That statement in response to the Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, which said that it has obtained information that the Navy has begun training exercises that threaten one of the most critically endangered species on Earth. On June 10th, the headless carcass of an endangered right whale calf was discovered just to the north of the area that has been designated as critical habitat for right whales. The Humane Society then learned that the Navy had been conducting live bombing exercises in the area and has called for a halt to the bombing. With only 300 of the animals remaining, the North Atlantic right whales are one of the world's most sensitive species. A spokesperson for the Humane Society expressed concern that, in conducting live bombing exercises, the Navy ignored steps required by the Endangered Species Act that would prevent possible harm to endangered whales. This incident is similar to one that occurred in January and February of 1996, when several right whales were found dead off the coast of Florida and Georgia, near their critical habitat in the southeast. At the time, the Navy was conducting live firebombing exercises just outside the critical habitat. No additional deaths occurred after the Navy moved the exercise area. The Brunswick Naval Air Station has refused to adopt such measures. Last night, the U.S. House and Senate passed different versions of the 2003 Defense Authorization Act. The House version of the bill would grant the Defense Department complete immunity from the Migratory Bird Treaty Act and broad leeway to ignore the Endangered Species Act. Pentagon spokespersons have also vowed to seek major relaxation of the Marine Mammal Protection Act, which is the most important law protecting whales. President Bush has indicated that environmental regulations on the military need to be relaxed to pursue the war on terrorism. Now the legislation only needs approval from the democratically controlled Senate. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Emily Bernhardt.
President Hamid Karzai vowed today to put Afghanistan's warlords out of business and called for international peacekeepers to be deployed in the unruly north. He told reporters that, quote, "Everyone has a chance to take part in the political process and serve Afghanistan, but no one will be allowed to serve in the interest of his fiefdoms and try to establish his own self-rule." It was a statement that surprised many observers. Afghanistan's loya jirga was marred with allegations of warlordism, with Karzai appointing Northern Alliance warlords governor of every province in Afghanistan. Free Speech Radio News correspondent Fariba Nawaz in the former Taliban stronghold of Kandahar. She takes a look at the province's governor and warlord, Golaga Shirzai.
He resembles an Afghan Santa Claus with a round belly and beard, except Golaga Shirzai, the governor of Kandahar, the Taliban's former stronghold, has a few front teeth left. He's a warlord, one that Afghan President Hamid Karzai kept in the transitional government. Shirzai, Abdul Rashid Dostum in the north and Ismail Khan in the west, were reinstated to rule over their regions despite objections from their local population. Also a former mujahid, Shirzai controlled part of Kandahar before the Taliban seized the city, where now 3,000 American troops operate on a base. Shirzai seems to have more support from Kandaris this time around, partly because he's receiving unquestionable support from the U.S., although he denies any monetary aid. In return, there's a sense of security in the city, one of the few places without a curfew. There are no peacekeepers here, but U.S. Special Forces patrol the streets frequently at night. Some locals say if it wasn't for U.S. support, Shirzai wouldn't survive, because other powerful warlords are vying for control in Kandahar. the governor claims complete sovereignty over the province.
I've given all the commanders weapons, and when we moved from Pakistan, we fought with Alpaid and the Taliban, and we chose everyone in Kandahar. There's nothing going on. The safety that's here is nowhere else.
Shopkeepers, shoppers, and taxi drivers say they're satisfied with Sherzai because he's allowing freedoms they only dreamed of under the Taliban. Performers are booking concerts. The economy is rapidly improving, and women are going to school and work. Nafas John, a widow with five children, says Sherzai can be governor as long as the city is at peace.
Gulaka is not shooting cannons. He's brought safety, and we're happy with him.
But Sherzai has his critics. They're hard to find because people are still scared to speak up against the government. Engineer Ismail, a building contractor who's itching to sign on to reconstruction projects, says Sherzai has employed all of his tribesmen to government posts, whether they're qualified or not. It's cronyism, he says.
People who aren't working properly or are taking bribes should be fired.
But he also says Sherzai is making more of an effort to rebuild the city, despite the lack of funding. The governor's right-hand men, Khalid and Yusuf Pashtun, his own cousins, are also his Western-educated advisors. They're the minds behind Sherzai's success so far. At lunch in the governor's palace recently, Sherzai signed whatever papers Yusuf Pashtun presented him, barely listening to his explanations. Then the governor, who has two wives and 16 children, changed to his pajamas and went for his siesta. Before that, he told the 30 men at the lunch table to take care of business. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Fari Banawa in Kandahar.
The United Nations says that China is on the brink of an HIV and AIDS catastrophe of unimaginable proportions in one of its harshest assessments yet of the country's efforts to stem the spread of the deadly virus. In a report entitled HIV and AIDS, China's Titanic Peril, the UN says that by the end of last year, 800,000 to 1.5 million Chinese were infected with HIV, the virus that can cause AIDS, reflecting an increase of more than 250,000 over the previous year. According to the UN report, China could have 10 million HIV sufferers by 2010 if no effective countermeasures are taken. Chinese officials rejected the report today, calling the UN predictions inaccurate and saying the report cannot be fully trusted. The report cites the most frequent modes of transmission as contaminated needles and illegal blood sales. Critics say these figures are skewed because so many infected gay men and lesbians are afraid to reveal their sexual orientation. Alan Lefkovich has the conclusion of a two-part report on gay rights in China.
Here in China, it's hard to be an homosexual. To avoid troubles, most still keep their orientation secret from families and co-workers because of heavy discrimination within Chinese society. Coming out publicly would be a disaster for an ordinary person. It would be fired and ostracized. While long-term jail sentences for homosexuals on hooliganism charges have become rare in recent years, police continue to promote fear in the community by occasionally rounding gays up and fining them or detaining them for several days. After the communist takeover of China in 1949, gays and anyone else engaging in other than limited range of government-sanctioned activities were persecuted. Fei is a lone lesbian I've met in a rock and roll disco, one of the famous entertainment places in Beijing. She lives with her girlfriend, Cheng, since 2 years, but she didn't say a word to her family.
Let's say that two women are living together. That is allowed. But if they want to be married, it won't be accepted by the legislation. Except if one of them made all the necessary surgical operations to become a man. But the most important thing is not to be married, even if it's the main destiny for the people in the tradition, but to be recognized by our relatives, by our friends, by our family. But around us, no family can accept the fact that we are lesbian.
Chen, Fei's friend, is 23 years old. She have a boy looking, she is short-haired, and she talk like guys. For her to say to her parents that she is a lesbian girl, it will kill her mother.
我能理解她的那种心情，因为做同性恋在现在这个社会来说是很难。
In China, there are a lot of backward people who can't accept us. So if I want happiness for my child, I think that the best way for him to take is the heterosexual one. I wish it very much for him.
An understanding wish in a society like China where more than 60% of the homosexual live a social heterosexual life. Here, if you want to exist as an homosexual, you should be married first. For the others, those who don't want to be married, it's difficult to meet others attracted to the same sex. In the countryside, it's quite impossible. And even in Beijing, there are only 3 places where gay and lesbians can meet each other. Dianinov Cafe is one of those places. Because of the social and family pressure, Conran Khan, the owner of the cafe, wanted to open a place where homosexuals could affirm their own identity and sexuality.
In the beginning, we had to ask for authorization to open a gay bar. When we went to the public security office, we had to explain what kind of bar it was. They didn't understand what a homosexual was, and when they understood, they made trouble. It was hard to obtain the right to open. But in the neighborhood, people didn't show us signs of discrimination. They just didn't understand who homosexuals are. Before opening the bar, I went to talk to the people, to eat in the Suwon restaurant just upstairs, to present myself and my sexuality. The people were really surprised because they thought homosexuals looked like women and that all lesbians were ugly. Then it changed. You know, China is a closed country where lack of information and education is deep. This lack creates a lot of misunderstanding and rejection. I mean, it's more a question of misunderstanding than it is a question of discrimination.
Frank Langfitt is a young American student in Beijing. When he graduates, he wants to promote the internet as a means of expression for gays and lesbians. For him, the new technology is air to breathe for this unknown community.
Well, I think actually what happened in China was really fascinating. For a long time in China, really for centuries, homosexuality has either been ignored or viewed as a mental illness. So it was very difficult for homosexuals to get together and to link up. And the internet opened here in the mid-1990s, and some very creative, very technologically savvy Chinese homosexuals decided that they would use this as a method to build a virtual community online. And one of the first things was Guangzhou Comrade, which was set up by a man named Roger Meng. And what he set up was an increasingly sophisticated web page that did everything from provide information on gay bars throughout the country to advice columns. One month he would run a series of stories on homosexuality in the Roman Catholic Church. He just dealt with a lot of gay issues. And this was, since it has been a taboo in this country, I think he provided a way for homosexuals to get together and also to sort of discuss in a safe atmosphere a lot of things that they were on their mind. One of the things that I think he found most heartening was he would get emails and phone calls from people in Sichuan province in small villages. And this meant enormous amount to them because they didn't understand what was going on in their lives. They didn't understand who they were, why they were different, and they could not talk to anybody in these small towns where they were for fear that they would be completely alienated.
Despite the existence of more than 100 gay interest websites in China, the homosexual community is still a virtual one. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Alan Lefkovich in Beijing.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. I'm Nell Abram.